Welcome to today's episode of The Power of Reinvention. Here we talk with my guests about the dreams, the visions, and the passions that individuals have every day and dare to explore them. Whether it's business or personal, you're entitled to live the life that you want, and no matter what the circumstances, you have the power to create success, fulfill your dreams, and live with passion. That's what I'm talking about. So dare greatly and happy reinventing, folks. Good afternoon and welcome to the Power of Reinvention. Well, it may be your morning, it may be your evening. It depends on where you are in the world, but I am thrilled to have you here and joining us. And my guest today is Vivian Paxinos, who is the CEO of Allbright. Vivian was appointed to the leadership role of Allbright in October of 2022. And with her extensive experience in driving tangible results and business growth, she is now running one of the most extraordinary organizations for women. And we're going to do a deep dive on this conversation today. And formerly, she was the global GM of UniDays, one of the world's leading student affinity networks. She successfully grew the business, connecting some of the world's leading lifestyle brands with new audiences. Previously, Viv has held senior roles for BBC Worldwide, Comcast, and Discovery, Inc. Vivian is a legacy of delivering global growth for brands through strategic insights and innovative creativity. And I am so excited to have you here on my podcast today, Viv. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathy. I'm thrilled to be here. Well,
typically, I introduce the podcast and why we're here before I do the bio. But I leaned right into my excitement of having you on here today. We've spent a lot of time together in the last month. I'm pleased to say we met for the first time probably 2 months ago when Vivian was in Los Angeles as the new CEO of this amazing Allbright organization. I was thrilled to meet her at a Sunday brunch that was hosted and get to know the new agenda for the Allbright, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But for those who don't know, just briefly, I wrote a book called Reinvent Your Life, What Are You Waiting For? It came out at the beginning of the pandemic, ironically, the week before we were all sent home to sit in front of our screens and figure out what to do with our lives. So the irony of the timing of my book was not lost on me. I launched a virtual chat series. It became like business and personal therapy for everybody that was trying to figure out what to do and how to get through the pandemic period. And at that time also then launched a podcast about a year and a half ago. So I'm really excited. I host incredible guests. We talk about all parts of our lives, men and women from different parts of the world and from all walks of life and all stations in life. So we're going to do a deep dive here with Viv today. And I'm going to start, Viv, by asking you, who was little Viv? Who were you as a young lady, a young girl? Big dreams, think you'd end up where you are today? Were there signs in an early life that you would become the leader that you have? And, you know, would love to just kind of know what was little Viv all about?
Yes, great question. So I was born and raised in Montreal. My parents immigrated to Montreal about 45 years ago. And I was very much, and I still am very much inspired by my parents. So they both worked. So I grew up both mom and dad working all the time. They worked really hard. And my mom still works. She's got her seventh business. She runs a dry cleaning business.
Maybe we need to interview her on this podcast as well.
And she's just relentless. But I grew up with like this work ethic, right? And the understanding that if you work hard, if you're passionate, and you know that you can grow and you can achieve any of your dreams. But also that something my dad always tells me is that I'm in control of my story, and I was in control of my dreams. And he told me that really early on. You know, I remember when it was time for me, you know, I'm the first one in my family to go to university. And when it was the time for me to go to university, my dad turned around and said, right, how are you going to pay for it? So even though I knew he could, he he asked me to work for it, right? And so I was working during the day, paying for my university or college, you know, college as they say in the US. And I think all of that just instilled this kind of this resilience, this determination, and fueled my, you know, my ambition. But also, when you're so accountable for your own results, you take it so much more seriously. My dad left his village in Greece when he was 13 because his entire family were farmers, and he wanted more. So he didn't see himself continuing his family legacy. So he left the village and went to Athens, and he worked during the day, studied in the evening. And so I was very inspired by that. And in a way, when I left Montreal to move to London, he was really upset. He's like, "Why are you leaving? We've given you everything in Montreal." And I said, "But you left your village when you were young." But he's like, "Yeah, but I had nothing. You have everything."
Interesting.
Here. And he still asks me, you know, "When are you coming back?" So I was very inspired by my parents. You know, my mom was always, you know, she's Spartan. So, you know, Spartan women were known kind of, you know, Greek history to be really powerful, really confident, really influential in society. So she always told me to make sure I make my own money, have my own bank account, be independent.
Amazing.
And from a very early age, so those really inspired me. And she always said, "There's nothing I couldn't do." And so I was raised with that. And with that, I was, you know, I was a very good student. I was a bit nerdy. I was, you know, sitting in the front of the class, always wanting to achieve my goals.
Were you the first to raise your hand?
Always.
Love that.
And I, you know, I liked results, right? So I liked to get assignments, and then see like my results at the end. So, and I just think that came from, you know, we're all so influenced by our upbringing, right? Whether we, you know, sometimes we only realize that later on in life. And when you're in the moment, I never realize how, you know, if I wanted to buy a new jacket, my parents were like, "Okay, well, we're just going to have to do more chores around the house and we'll give you some money to buy." And I didn't realize why they were being so tough on me. And I thought my friends didn't really have it that tough. And it was all to teach me the lessons that are just so valuable now.
That's incredible.
And so that, you know, that gave me big dreams. When I was 18, I moved out of the house and I said, "I'm going to live on my own and I'm going to pay my own university, pay my own rent." My parents only lived 30 minutes away. And I decided, well, I'm going to go after the life that I want. And it's very difficult as a Greek woman, right? Because you're
kind of a culture, tradition, right?
In a Greek community where we went to the Greek shops, went to the Greek bank, we watched, you know, it was all. And so, you kind of marry into the Greek family and that's the way I was raised. And so it was I was a bit of the black sheep in that sense. And, you know, I was the first one in my family for my siblings to go to university. And so on. And I just, you know, was, I guess, inspired by my parents and also the desire to want more. I didn't feel there was enough diversity. And it leads to what I'm doing now in the community that I was, right? I was around the same people all the time, which I love my heritage, but I wanted more and I wanted to see more. And so I moved out at a really young age. And then I moved to London in my early 20s, was just a backpack, a hockey bag, obviously, because I'm Canadian.
That's great.
A hockey bag, and started from scratch, really. And I just saw an ad in the paper for a job at MTV, and I thought that could be quite cool as my first job in London. Yeah. And when I went in for that role, and I remember like it was yesterday, the person that was supposed to interview me was sick. So I got interviewed by somebody more senior and I was going in for like an account manager or a sales role. And then I ended up working with that man for about 15 years.
Unbelievable.
After that. Yes. So we worked together at Viacom. We worked together at BBC. We worked together at A. So we ended up and he mentor, coach, you know, and a friend now. And so it's funny how things work out. I always say, like, we're exactly where we need to be in life, even if things are not always going our way. And that's a great example of that.
I love that. And what an amazing story. I love the perspective you have on the impact that your childhood and your parents' nurturing of your independence. And, you know, the irony, I can't forget what you said about your father saying, "Well, why are you leaving? When, you know, when are you coming back?" It's so interesting that they really set you up for confidence and success and some of the tools that many people do not grow up with. I often say about my own life that my parents also set me up to be entrepreneurial and believe I could do anything I want. Those were sort of the yin yang of both of my two parents and their different ways and styles and who they were in the world. And it gave me the tools to believe, as I've run a business for 35 years, that I could do anything and I was an entrepreneur and that I was entitled to create the life I wanted. And that's very much the premise of what we talk about around reinvention and just knowing that we are entitled to have the life we want. And it may not be in front of us and it may not seem readily attainable, but if we believe at our core that we are at least entitled, we might be able to figure out how to get there and how to create it. And it may be a 5-year reinvention. It could be a 10-year reinvention. But if we put one foot in front of the other and move towards that goal, we will wake up one day and go, wow, I created this. I did this. I made it happen because I believed that this is what I should have in my life. And I think that's the beauty of these conversations where we share with others the possibility. I often say to those who may not come from the place or the parenting or the, you know, the tools that we might have been given or exposed to, put on a pair of rose-colored glasses and just look at the world through those for 5 minutes. Things look a little different. Create that imposter syndrome moment. See yourself as something as you may not be today, but that you aspire to be, so that if you see it, you can be it. And that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing to see that for ourselves and aspire to create that. And it feels like that's kind of what you've done with every step along your journey. And I'm sure there were challenges, and I'd love you to sort of share, were there moments, crossroads, challenges where you just sat there going, oh my goodness, what am I doing? I'm crazy. This is not right for me. Why am I here? Were there moments where you sort of questioned what you were doing or sort of got to that gnawing feeling of, it may be time to sort of make a pivot?
I mean, gosh, so many, right? And, you know, I have a string of success and a string of failures behind me. And I'm really proud of both. And it was interesting. I was having this discussion with somebody else the other day, and they said, oh, I never make mistakes. I just have lessons. And I was like, well, why are we branding mistakes and failures as just lessons as what we take from them? But it's okay, right? It's really okay to say, I've had failures. I've tried something. It didn't work. And that's totally fine. And I really want to take that stigma away from it, right? Because it's how I've grown and how I've pivoted and so on. I think there were two, I started my career in media, and I'll answer your question, but one of the things that really led to my success and my growth as a leader was my curiosity, right? It always came from wanting to understand, I'm a bit of a magpie, always asking questions. I never felt like I was stepping on anyone's toes. I'm sure I would. I just never understood that expression. What does it mean to step on people's toes? If I'm coming from a perspective, I'm just trying to find solutions. So I'm constantly asking for questions. I'm constantly looking at the data. And I was always wanting to understand new technologies. And so by being so curious, by wanting to always learn, I think that's really helped me navigate and grow within my career. And that's really helped me, shape me as a leader as well. I mean, after many years of, when I was at the BBC, I had put together some business plans to grow into new markets, to launch new products, had all of that approved and so on. And then the market, the economy collapsed at the time. It was in 2008. I remember that vividly. And I had lost the company almost £1 million from the initiative, right? And I was asked to go to a board meeting to talk about it. And I was like, my knees were shaking, right? I was just so afraid. And we were launching into a new market. I had mobilized a team in that market. I don't remember how much we lost, but it was a significant amount. And I mean, I had nothing else to say but own up to, like, the timing was really bad. You know, I could not have predicted this. And so I controlled the controllables, which was I did all the due diligence, all the right, everything I was supposed to do. And then there were circumstances outside of my control that just the market collapsed. It was in, it was a business venture in the Middle East, and it was a time where that it really the real estate market really collapsed there, and that had an impact on the economy, and we had to just kill the project. But I had to go in and just say, you know what, it's, we just have to kill the project. The timing's not right. We're going to have a loss of X. And, you know, well, we just need to revisit this project in a few years. I didn't apologize. Right. I just said,
this is business.
This was outside of my, you know, this is it. This was, and that was the real, and I remember, because I remember my knees under the table shaking. I thought, I'm going to get fired. you know, I was really nervous. I was still, I was pretty,
I was going to say, you were probably young where that sort of reality.
Young, and I had a lot of responsibility and belief from leaders around me. And they said, look, you know, we would have made the same decision. And thank you for, you know, thank you for your recommendation. And you, that's it. Keep going. And I was like, is that it? So that was an interesting. That was an interesting moment for me. And then it was my decision to leave media and to pivot. So I, you know, after 15 years in the media industry, working for some amazing companies, including Warner, Discovery Warner, and I led the Olympics partnerships. So I did some fantastic work there. I really wanted to upskill and diversify my skill set. I didn't want to be pigeonholed as just like one area of expertise, which I knew so well. And I decided I'm going to work for a tech company at heart. That's the only roles I wanted to look for. And I wanted to be around e-commerce. I knew nothing about e-commerce, but it was booming. This was pre-COVID, and there was just so much, you know, I was so interested around performance marketing, e-commerce, marketplaces, how that entire technology worked. And I left my role at Discovery Warner, and I thought it was going to be really easy for me to, everyone's like, oh, no problem, you're going to get another job so quickly. And it wasn't. I got quite a few rejections. By then I was pretty senior. I was, you know, vice president of the, you know, one of the largest divisions in EMEA at Discovery. And I couldn't find a job, and I left without having one.
So that was a risky thing to leave without a job in place, right? And a lot of people are confronted with that situation where they know it's time to leave, right? They know it's time to move on. The security of waiting till you find something else versus really sort of stepping back, right? That ability to step back, if you can do that and leave and then contemplate without all the pressure around you. You know, did you weigh that carefully and try to decide what sort of motivated you to make the decision you made at that point?
Well, I wasn't feeling inspired in the role. I felt like it was time to do something different. So I evaluated, okay, you know, I did have consulting opportunities that I lined up. So it wasn't like I was not earning. And so that de-risked
That's
it a little bit.
Great
but
point,
if I didn't have those opportunities, I probably wouldn't have left because I, you know, working mom, you know, we to income household, I would have needed to work, right? So I did have those, and I felt that I could keep those ticking along until I found something that was really for me. And so that's how I evaluated the opportunity and the risk. And everyone makes different, you know, everyone has a different situation. So you'd have to, you know, if you can't afford the time not to work, right? If you can't, then you have to make those decisions, right? Because at the end of the day, we all have bills to pay. So you have to. So I weighed it up that way. I had enough to keep me, enough contracts to keep
That's
me going,
great.
And whilst I was able to then focus on my search. But it was a real eye opener, like that search, finding the, you know, my new role took me a long time. I mean, a long time to me, because like, I'm not a very patient person. So it took me 6 months.
Well, that is a long time when you're feeling unsure. It's not just the
months,
unemployed. It's the I'm not sure what I'm doing with my life.
Sure.
And we are so defined by what we do every day for the most part. So investing the time into creating the right thing is really important, but many don't have the luxury of being able to find the right thing or, you know, being able to work in spaces that they want. So 6 months can be a very long time to be unsure when it's so attached to
And it affects
you.
Your
Absolutely.
Confidence. Every time you get rejection, it affects your confidence, and And then I pivoted and I joined UniDays, which is an e-commerce marketplace for that connects Gen Z with brands. And that was completely right. different. I'd never done anything like that. I loved it. And I learned so much in the time that I was there. And I was able to scale that platform from, you know, 7 to almost 20 million users in a space of 3 years. When I moved on from there, and I'll explain why I moved on later on, but I was filled with so much belief and confidence in myself, which was great because it was an industry that I had no experience in, but it just made me feel like, should we have so many skills that are transferable?
Yeah.
Right. And from what I said around my beginning and being curious and being, I'm always focused on the customer and the consumer and what is it they need. And if you apply that, I apply that to everything I do and looking at the data, I was able to pick it up really yeah. quickly. And I hope to inspire women to feel the same because we all have transferable yeah. skills. So it's that growth mindset. It's more our mindset that holds Absolutely. Us back. So I often talk about that pivot to a completely new industry and leaving my contacts, my network. And I mean, I'm still very connected with them, but to pivot it was, you know, very bold. And I think that's really... You know, I think that's really important to sometimes take risks and be bold, right,
yeah,
in your
and
career.
And it's interesting, you know, it's incredible segue into what you're doing right now at Albright, but I heard what you just said about the reason you left UniDays and what occurred in that process. I don't know if there's a yeah. story in that, so I don't want to circumvent
did
that.
Did I tell you the story?
No.
So I had my second baby during COVID, which is a COVID baby, and... I went back to work like a few weeks later because I loved what I was doing. I had a really big team. We were all working from home. So I thought, what's the worst that can happen? I'm just going to get back right. into work. So I took almost no time off and I continued working so hard. And I underestimated I have a big gap between my two children. I underestimated the emotional, the mental drain.
On you.
You know, having a newborn.
On you.
On me.
Wow. Wow.
On me, yeah. And I was nursing and taking calls. I was in between. I wanted to stay connected to work so badly for some reason. And then at the end of that year, I was burnt out. I was not like pleasant to be around. I was exhausted. I wasn't enjoying work, which is not like me. I'm always more than glass
right.
half full. Like I'm like,
go,
you know,
go, go,
the pitcher
right.
on the side waiting to keep right. filling it up.
Right? I hear you.
And I had to stop, you know, working and take and reflect again. And that was another aha moment where I thought, oh, actually, I'm not making this work for me. Right. And realizing that is really important. Being able to put yourself, take yourself out of that
was there,
situation.
Let me ask you: was there a sort of a watershed moment? I mean, it sounds like this was probably accumulating, but was there a watershed moment where yeah. you were just like, "Enough! I really have to deal with this. I have to confront how I'm really feeling." You know, did you drop the baby? Did you drop the work deadline? Like, was there some watershed moment that kind of just made you just go, "Okay, I really do have to take this seriously"? Or was it just at some point you talked it through enough with yourself or your loved ones and they all said, yeah, it's time to take a step back?
I just, I was really exhausted. Mm. I had lost a lot of my patience. Mm. I would not show it during the day, but in the evening I was constantly in tears with my husband saying, I'm so tired, yeah. I'm exhausted. And he's like, can you just, like, let's just take yeah. some time off, right? We're lucky enough to have been in the position where
right.
I could take the time off at that point. I was, you know, further down in my career than I was earlier. And I was just, I couldn't sleep, you know, and I didn't know that it was burnt. I was just thought, oh, you know, maybe it's just time to move on. But I was just, and I underestimated the, you know, one, the importance of connecting with your newborn in those first
yeah.
few months. And you know, as you, I think we wrap ourselves up so much in the work that we do, and it defines us in so many ways. And I found, you know, those few months having work, and I probably didn't do my team any favors, because I would dip in and dip out, right? Instead of going on proper maternity leave.
And empowering and them to be who they needed to be to support you better or to do the work that had to be done, right? I appreciate that. And I think this...
Yeah, so I felt in a way, it was a way to validate, oh, I'm still here, I'm important, I've got my job. And then I've got the child, but I've got this other big job that I'm really enjoying. Yeah. And in fact, at the end of this month, I booked myself doing a nice meditation retreat at the end of the month, which is the first time I've booked one, because it's, I realized from that experience at Uni Day, is to prevent burnout, right? And to prevent and to re-energize in a different way and on my own. So I'm taking 2.5 days and I'm stepping away. And there's like silent walks and meditation and workshops to really prioritize well-being, right? And myself, because we just rarely do it.
And I think, you know, it's so interesting. I feel like this is the first summer where I am hearing so many people, not just women, but people across the board. I think everybody really, when you look at the big lesson that we all learned in the last 3 years because of the pandemic, was the prioritization of health and wellness, the prioritization of ourselves, and the ability to say, okay, I'm going to do exactly what you just described in whatever form that is for any of us. But it's the first summer that I think really people are taking it seriously and finding a way to indulge. It's not like, oh, I'm going on vacation, but don't tell anybody, or I'm taking a few days off, or I'm going to take Friday summers, or whatever that is. I find that people are very much wearing it as a badge of honor and trying to empower other people to understand the value proposition of it and the importance of it. And I feel that that is one of the big lessons coming out of the human side of what we all went through because of the pandemic that has enabled us all to sort of get off this insanely, insanely crazy life treadmill. And I find, like, I'm Australian, and I find that Australians always prioritize, you know, long lunches, don't take work home. They take their holidays seriously. Yeah. And here in the US and probably Europe, I think there is this, you know, has been such this intensity in our lives in the last 10, 15 years, and the chase and the need to just always be on. And look, your story of what you were going through when you had your baby, like, it's okay to stop and to nurture ourselves, and we come back the better for it. And not be apologetic. Yeah. We have to be completely unapologetic as women, particularly, and really sort of own that conversation. And here you are now as the CEO of Albright, and I'd love you to share, for those who don't know what Albright is, not only what Albright is, what you're doing now in this role that enables you to further the gender equality, pay gap issues, the things that are really impacting women in the workplace and in life. I mean, the workplace is a big part of our lives. It's who we are. So please share a bit about that, because you have an incredible opportunity, and it's extraordinary. Yeah.
Absolutely. Gosh, I love my job.
Love that. Can I say that? Yes, really, everybody should be able to say that. I say it all the time. I have the hashtag, love my job.
Love my job when work doesn't feel like work, right? And I think it's a perfect blend of mission and capital. And I really believe that mission and capital can coexist. We're a great example of it. So for your listeners who don't know what Albright is, we are the global home for ambitious women. Our mission is to really remove barriers for women in the workplace. We have a network of 500,000 women. We're on track to reach 1 million women by December. And we support women through upskilling, through networking and mentoring. And we will also have a B2B solution where we work with organizations to help them drive growth through diversity and inclusion. And so we go into a workplace and we use a data science tool that helps some companies understand how people are feeling around culture. We do it through the lens of female, of course, because we need to level the playing field for women, and women are still facing a lot of challenges in the workplace. But then once we get that data, because I strongly believe we can't change what we can't measure. And so we get that data, we create a blueprint for companies to make changes so they can drive better business results through supporting women in the workplace. We believe that if we can make work for all women, we make work for everyone. And then it's an annual program. At the end of the program, we do another data check to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. So that's what Allbright is. We have incredible physical spaces. We have conferences that we actually take into the U.S. later this year as well. And so it's all around really optimizing, I say, society and businesses for greatness, right? Because if you don't invest in diversity and inclusion, if you're not supporting women, then you're really not investing in your brand health, right? So that is really what we stand for.
That's amazing. And do you find that there are big differences between what you're experiencing? You're in London, and that's where Allbright started. Are you finding U.S., we've had the Allbright, and I just have to give an honorary mention to our amazing friend, Lisa Licht, who introduced me to Allbright about 4 years ago when it first started in the U.S. and has sort of kept us all really, you know, engaged and involved and continues to do so. But have you seen big differences, or do you see them between the European and U.S. markets, the culture and the corporate work environment, the way women are dealing with these issues of diversity and gender pay gap? And I'm curious to know, you know, is it the same work, or you've got sort of an agenda for the European or English market, if you will, and then for the U.S.? How does it differ?
Yeah. So our agenda is tailored by market and by company that we work with and the input we get from our community. So we have 30% of our communities in the U.S., so we survey them regularly. And our latest Future of Work survey, the data was quite alarming, where only 10% of women felt satisfied with their careers and were planning to stay in their roles for 5 years and longer. And we see those challenges at a senior level, I would say, across the board, both in Europe. We've seen it in New Zealand. We've seen it around the world. And we see it in the U.S. as well, with there's more senior women leaving the workplace. And actually, interestingly enough, in the U.S., we had a higher proportion of women saying they were going to step down due to burnout.
Wow.
Yeah, and the lack unrealistic expectations, slightly more than in the UK, but still was. So we're still seeing a lot of that, and that's why that mental health and well-being is really important to us as a business. So we feel like to be the best that you can be in the workplace, you also have to be thinking about your well-being, and it goes together. And as women, sometimes we don't think about that, right? Because we prioritize so many everyone else.
Oh, yes,
before
we
ourselves.
Do. We put our oxygen mask on first, and no, we don't. We don't,
yes,
actually.
Exactly.
We need to put our oxygen mask on first.
We need to put it on first. And when you look at representation at a board level, we've got quite good representation in Europe, but still a very small percentage. Only 8% of the FTSE 250 companies are female CEOs. So there's a lot more work to be done. I think a lot about the middle management. I refer to it as that messy middle. And when you look at the gender pay gap, in their 20s, it's not like the difference isn't as wide, and it widens when women are in their 30s. And in fact, women earn 60% less for the first 10 years after they have children, and they never manage to catch up to men. So they earn 60% less after they have children. And then that becomes a catalyst for not progressing, not wanting to go for the more senior roles, leaving the workplace. So I'm really thinking a lot about how do we support those mid-level managers? Because if we can support women earlier in their career, then we'll prepare them for C-suite, for board roles, we'll retain them longer. There's a lot of focus on senior women, but I don't feel like there's enough in that middle management that really struggle, right? You're going through a lot of changes at that time, whether you're buying your first house, having children, going back to all of that. There's a lot of going on in your life. So I really think about what we can do for that middle layer as well as the more senior
women.
So what
is the programming that Albright is offering that is going to enable more women to be exposed to these conversations, to gain the tools that they need to affect that change?
Yeah, we've got very clear programming pillars. So we've got one that is for female founders, you know, regardless. So one of the things that really differentiates us is we support women across all stages of their career, right? And we believe that's really important. And I fundamentally believe if we're supporting women across all stages of their career, that's how we can drive systemic change, right? And that's really important. So we start with supporting female founders because we need more. You know, we can add so many billions to the economy if we have women starting businesses at the same pace as men. And I forget the exact data around that, but it's something that's really important to us and making sure we're nurturing that community of female founders. So we've got a pretty robust program to support female founders. We then have middle level management program called Career Accelerator, which is a 12-week program that helps you take that next step into senior leadership. Overlaying that, we've launched with Google a program called Reignite, which supports women going back to work. And that could be going back to work after a career break, going back to work after having children, regardless of the reason, just supports more women going back to work. And then our senior program is called Career Elevator, which is supporting senior C-suite women to take their next step, whether that's a board role or, you know, a C-suite role. So we've got three clear programs, and that's what
that's
we focus
fantastic.
On. And then amongst all of that, we curate about 300 events a year.
Yes, you do.
we do lots of different events and all of it through the lens of, you know, again, we speak to our community a lot, and it's just really understanding what they need to achieve their career aspirations. And so we tend to have quarterly themes based on what we see, what's happening, what are the trends. And I think it's a really hard time at the moment with, you know, cost of living, interest rates rising, inflation everywhere. Women and men are worried. So we need to make sure that women are really taking ownership, and we're empowering them to
and giving them the tools.
And
I was going to say
them.
The support, the community, the conversation. You've been so incredibly honest about really what you went through, the tough times, the challenging times. We've all got to feel comfortable. I was at a dinner last night with 17 women, and it was just the most honest, open, raw conversation of the hard stuff, the challenges, the exposure, where people can then lean in and say, hey, I've got maybe a solution for you, or an idea, or someone to introduce you to, or another way to look at this. And when you can have those conversations in a safe place, which is what I think is very much what Albright creates, the virtual conversations, the in-person conversations, the tools, you know, that's what women need right now to get through these really challenging times.
Yeah. I mean, if I can leave any tips behind, is really to take those opportunities to network. And I know some people don't like the word network, but when you approach it with a mindset of building relationships rather than collecting
exactly.
business cards, look at us. We met quickly at an event, and I was like, oh, I love your energy.
Right,
let's grab coffee. Let's meet up, right? And it's just, you know, we're all there. Everyone's going through the same thing. So network, build relationships, and don't be afraid to pivot. I think it's, you know, whenever there's a setback, that is an opportunity to then pivot into something
and also
different.
And also, I think when you're going through something like that, also think about how you can mentor others. Because you'd be surprised what you learn about yourself when you actually open your heart and your mind and your accessibility to others who are going through something similar or challenging. And it reminds you, it actually reinforces what you're made of. And you hear yourself in the life lessons. We talked earlier about transferable skills. I had this conversation with someone last night who's just left a really high power job in programming, in the sports world, and she's trying to find her next job. And I said, isolate the sports part of it, or isolate the programming part of it. what are you really passionate about? She said, well, I want to stay in the world of sports. And I said, okay, so think about programming in a whole different way. If you could work in any sports organization, what would you want to do there? What would you feel comfortable with that you have been really phenomenal at? And she said, wow, I never really thought about it that way. And I said, well, you know, lead with, I want to stay in sports, not I want to lead with programming. And then see what else you can do in sports where you bring a certain skill set to the table that could be transferable into something else. And yeah. I think that's where we have to be able to have those conversations and you know, be able to think that way.
I love that. And then manifest that. And then she should tell everyone she knows she wants to stay in sports. I mean, I remember when I was interviewed for the role at Unidice, and the CEO said to me, what do you want to do? I'm like, I'd like to be a CEO. So I'd like to have your job.
I love that.
And he was like, great. I love it. He's like, fantastic. So manifest it. Be okay to talk about. That's what I'm looking for. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, sadly, we're getting close to the end of this conversation, but I'm glad it's not our last conversation. And I have a really fun question to ask you, which is if you were to have a dinner party, you could have three or four amazing, inspirational people at that table, dead or alive. And let's hope they're, you know, alive for the purpose of your dinner party, but someone who maybe is no longer with us. Who would you want to have a glass of wine and break bread with and just be inspired or entertained by?
I mean, I would love to, you know, Michelle or Barack Obama. I love their energy. Ruth Ginsburg. I think Tom Hanks would be really interesting.
He's got such stories.
I'm a big fan.
Stories.
I'm a big fan. So there's a few people that I would, gone now, but I was, you know, really inspired and read books by Nelson Mandela. And I really absolutely loved, and, you know, I spent lots of time in South Africa and reading and learning all about him. So I think that's somebody I would have loved to have met, because that
energy. I love that table. I'm definitely coming to that dinner. I love that. Viv, thank you so much for being on the show today. Thank you so much for sharing so much of yourself and inspiring others, and for the work that you're doing with Albright. I'm going to make sure that everybody that listens or reads about this podcast knows how to reach you on LinkedIn and through, you know, the links to Albright. I know you're taking on new members every day, and I highly encourage everybody to look into what Albright could do for them. I think you have built with the team, and I've met many of your amazing teams, such an incredible community, and it's global and it's wonderful. And so grateful that we got connected. And thank you again for being here.
Oh, well, thank you for having me and for giving me the opportunity to share my story.
Absolutely. And happy reinventing, everybody. There will be details in the show notes. You can always go to the website at thereinventionexchange.com for more details, information, lots and lots of podcasts and blogs and anecdotes and stories and links to all kinds of organizations that could help you in any part of your life. So thank you for joining us, and happy reinventing. Thanks for listening to The Power of Reinvention. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review the show. Wouldn't mind a 5-star review. It would be greatly appreciated. Also, be sure to visit thereinventionexchange.com to share your reinvention stories, suggest a guest, join the newsletter mailing list, get access to my book, which is called Reinvent Your Life, What Are You Waiting For?, and discover fantastic bonus content with my blogs, and listen in to the Reinvention Virtual Chat series. Don't forget to join me next week for another episode. Please share with a friend. And thank you for listening. Happy reinventing.